Thumbtack presents the ins and outs of caring for your home. Out. Uncertainty. Self-doubt. Stressing about not knowing where to start. In. Plans and guides that make it easy to get home projects done. Out. Word art. Sorry, live, laugh, lovers. In. Knowing what to do, when to do it, and who to hire. Start caring for your home with confidence. Download Thumbtack today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Greene from the Commercial Break Podcast. It's likely you've heard of the show if you're directly related to me or you follow our MySpace page. But I'm not here to talk to those three listeners. I'm here to appeal to people who haven't heard the show. Along with my co-host, Kristen Joy Hoadley, we're taking a deeper look at the topics that are affecting our youth today. Like, who are the people who are dating ghosts? Where did all these pickup artists come from? And why doesn't my preacher have a nicer private jet? We understand that these are the issues you really want to get to the bottom of. The Commercial Break is now available on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.
Now, the host of the Home Improvement Show, Rich Orris, on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning. Welcome to the KMOX Home Improvement Show, your one-stop shop for all expert advice on any home maintenance, remodeling, repair. We got you covered today. I'm Rich Orris, here to help you tackle any project, big or small, and keep your home in tip-top shape. Let's just keep everything really, really good. There's nothing better for return on investment of your home than just keeping up with the general maintenance and that everybody will notice and that wants. So what do you got going on? You got a leaky faucet, you're thinking about a kitchen remodel, you're wondering how to boost your home's energy efficiency, you can give me a call right here today, 314-436-7900, and let's talk about it. Let's get it out. And hey, talking together about this is great on the air because then there's so many people that might not call in but have the same types of issues going on that they're wondering, and they get to hear it and they get to hear some great advice on it. So whatever you need, if you're looking for you're just a DIY weekend warrior, or you're just looking for the right pro to get the job done for you, I've got the tips, the tricks for you, the expert advice, anything you need. Again, there's nothing in our way today. We got 2 full hours to cover for all your questions and conversations today. Again, 314-436-7900 will get you right in here to me today. Let's figure out who is going to be our first caller today. The phone lines are wide open, so let's get this thing going. And, you know, I like to start out with different things that just commonly occur sometimes or common conversations. And just last night, I was just having a conversation with my son-in-law, because he's kind of, well, younger, he's new in the business, he's been in here a while, but yet there's always a lot to learn and a lot that we can learn. And he's remodeling their hall bathroom at his and my daughter's house. And so we were just talking about some of the different things and what he's kind of got to do next. And he's like, yeah, I'll be starting the drywall. I'm like, well, you know, how much taping and mudding have you done? And he's like, well, not enough, not a whole lot, but enough. And really for me, I mean, growing up in this industry, starting this when I was in my late teens, 19 years old, that sort of thing, and just learning as I go, and just having the dedication and the desire to do more, to better yourself, can get you so much, and it can take you so far in life. Honestly, I feel no matter what you're doing, it doesn't have to be you're in the housing, the home building, the remodeling, that sort of industry to be that way. You can be that way in any industry there is, but in particularly for ours and for what I do and what we discuss here, there's a lot to be said for that, because like Scott Mosby used to say all the time, and I lived it, and I'd done it. I've been doing it with him for 23 years. We're not all perfect, and we don't all know everything, and we never will. But the good thing is we can learn something new every day. We can keep going, and we can help spread that. But we can also learn from the mistakes too. We can learn from, so what Scott used to always say that I just absolutely loved was he's got a lot of these answers because he's done it wrong so many times. And once you start to figure it out and then you're getting it right, that's great. You can, so, and I've had the some of the same experiences. You do something and you go, oh wow, that wasn't the greatest idea ever. We should probably redo that because that just didn't work out the way I was hoping it would. And then you ask advice and you do things and you find a better way to do it. And then you know more than you knew the day before. And that's great. And I think it will, in our industry, for homeowners too, just kind of going through learning, talking about what's the best way to caulk, what's the this, that. There's so much that we can get out there. And of course, for my son-in-law, I was like, "Well, you know, I'll stop by if I can. I'll give you some tips. If you're having issues, let me know. Ask me some questions. I'll come over. I'll show you things that I used to do and what I'd learned." And there's a lot of things out there. Starting out as a painter, of course, got into drywall. Even back then, a little bit of plaster patching, drywall, hanging, patching, taping, mudding. I got a lot better at this than I care to admit. But getting started, I was telling my son-in-law, okay, I'm like, well, so I remember like it was yesterday, the real first patch, and it was a plaster patch, so it wasn't drywall, that I had ever done. And we did a lot of work when I worked with my father in the city, downtown, older buildings, rentals. He had a management company. He managed some buildings. He owned some buildings, some four family flats. So as we all know, there's a lot of plaster involved in that. And so my first plaster patch above my dad's office was a couple of stories of apartments that the management company we had done a lot of work for managed. And so I come in the office and it's towards the end of the day, and he's like, "Hey," my dad says, "go up to this unit upstairs." And he says, "when you go in on the right hand side, you'll see the hole in the wall. Just go up there and patch that hole in the wall." And I'm like, "Oh yeah. Okay." You know, like, so I've never really done that. And he was basically like, "Well, but you've seen me do it. You've seen Charlie do it. You've seen some of the guys do it, and you've painted over it. So you've kind of, you're starting at one step. Now you're going to the next. So just go do it, learn it." And I'm like, "Oh wow." He's like, "I got tools up there for you. I got my knives, my stuff you'll need. It's all sitting there. Just get it done." And of course, oh my gosh, it was plaster. So I'm putting in the mesh and stuff, and I'm mixing the plaster, and the plasters, I've got more plaster on the floor because I've got it too wet or I've got it too dry, and I'm trying to get it right. And that was kind of what we were talking about a little bit last week with the caulking, where it's like, boy, there's all these tips and tricks and tools. I just saw a video. I don't remember if it was like Instagram or Facebook or, you know, one of these reels, that it was caulking, and the guy like took the caulk gun and he put the caulk. He really was sporadic with how he put the caulk in the corner, and he went way out off onto like the countertop and did it like real super squiggly. And he took this tool and he ran it towards himself, and that caulk turned out looking perfectly to the naked eye on this camera, this video shot of it. But when I look at it, and what you'll see later if you had done that, is there's almost an inch of real thin light caulk on that countertop that's going to have a different sheen than the countertop. And you're going to see it. Eventually you will see that dirt will stick to caulk. So if you get the caulk 3/4 of an inch or more out onto the countertop, it's a good idea to clean that off to have a good lasting product left for you that you're not going to be looking at a year or two from now going, oh man, everything stuck to it. Now I can see all this gunk on my countertop from the caulk sticking out an inch, real thin and different kind of sheen over that. And I'm like, so yeah, you got to be careful, because you see that and you think, boy, where do I get that tool? That's awesome. But it's really not necessarily as good as it seems. And so really getting good at it is what's going to add a lot of value to the years that last on that caulking job. And same for my first plaster job. Boy, it took a lot more time to get that first one done than it did to get that last one done that I did. But it's just a lot of on hands getting through it through the years. So that's what we've got going here. We do the best we can to help you out, to help everybody. I know it's Super Bowl weekend, so everybody's getting prepared. Everybody's probably grocery shopping. You got your to-do list, all sorts of things going on. So feel free to give me a call. Let's get some in, and I'm seeing the phone starting to light up, so you can get to me at 314-436-7900. Right here today, we've got plenty happening. We got plenty for you. We're going to take our first break. Don't go nowhere. I'll get to more with you as soon as we return. All right, we are back. Home Improvement Show for everybody today. You can find me again, don't forget, right now, 314-436-7900. Get you straight in. Anything you got, anything you need. Let's jump right to Doug and see what's going on with Doug. Are you there? Can you hear me, Doug? Hey, Doug? You are. What's going on today?
I got two real quick questions about, I don't know if it's an expansion tank, a surge tank, what you call it, that's on a water heater. What does it do? And I was told when I bought a new one that you should replace them every 5 years, and I was trying to see if that was a fact.
Okay, so the expansion tank, basically what it does is it's a space for kind of like a tank that can be filled if your tank is overheating, if it's expanding. It will absorb some of that steam, some of that water, and it has a bladder inside of it that will expand, that will fill that tank. It's basically battles against the water heater's over-expanding, overheating, and exploding is basically what it's trying to do. I don't know. I can tell you this. The life expectancy of a water heater is like 12 years, give or take 8 to 15, 16, something like that. I don't know that I don't know the life expectancy of the expansion tank, what they say, but I would think it's got to be close to the same as the water heater. And my thing would be, when you get a new water heater, get a new expansion tank. But they can go bad, and typically when they do, they leak. So like the seam will, there's a welded seam that might crack, and then you'll start getting a drip out of it and water marks on the side of it. And so I have seen them go bad, but 5 years seems relatively quick to me, but I don't know the exact answer. We should chat GPT this thing and see what kind of range it gives. But you got to be careful, too, when you research the different life expectancies and stuff, because it can be a pretty wide range. It may start at 5 years, but then it may go to 15 or 20. So that's the hard part. But 5 years does seem pretty quick to me for replacing
that. That's what I thought too. And I got almost 19 out of the both of them. So I'm saying I came out pretty good on that one as far as
definitely
getting the life out of it.
Yeah, for both. Yeah, absolutely. 19 anymore is a really long time for a water heater. Now, if you bought your water heater in like 1974, you probably still have it. Because
right.
those you see them 40 years, some of those would go, and they just don't make them like they used to. I don't think.
No, they don't.
Yeah.
I appreciate your taking the time to talking with me, and you have a nice day.
Hey, you too. I appreciate it. And that's a really good question. I'll do some research on that, and I'll definitely come back with more info on that maybe even a different week, next week or something. But I do like to mark some of these and then do a little more research. I have a licensed plumber at my at our office that I'll go back, same thing with like our licensed electrician, stuff like that. So when I read things, hear things, a lot of times I'll go talk to them too prior to truly reporting, because a lot of this stuff too is it comes down to a matter of, well, like we were kind of just talking about before, about learning through the trade and experience. And so a matter of what you've experienced, what you've seen, how old are they when you see them go bad? So it's more of an opinion. So sometimes if you were to research how long, what's the life expectancy of an expansion tank for a water heater, and the 5 years might be the manufacturer, kind of like the toothpaste people making the end of the tube bigger so that more comes out so that you use more. So they're saying, we've seen them go bad in five. Well, it doesn't mean that you have to change it in five. It means keep your eye on it. So having some knowledge and experience kind of plays into that whole life expectancy answer. Another one we've talked about quite often is when you get a new water heater, and if Doug, if you're out there and you're getting a new water heater, I've had this conversation with a lot of different people, and I've had it with my licensed plumber too, about should you flush that water heater? So a lot of the recommendation is flush that water heater out, empty it completely once a year, drain it down, run some water through it. So turn the water on and kind of flush it out, get the calcium deposits, all the stuff out of it, so that it should keep it cleaner and increase the life expectancy of the whole unit, because you're getting all those deposits and all that out of the inside of that tank. And when you've seen, as tanks get older and start to go bad, we've heard the popping noise that they make, and that's the calcium. And so it'll sound like boiling water and popping real loud. And that's a lot of calcium inside, around the heaters, on the anode rod, all that. So if you flush it, it'll be cleaner, and it could last longer, get longer lasting value for you. But when I talked to my licensed plumber about it, he said, that's great. If you get a new water heater and you start that after 12 months and you do it religiously every 12 months, that's a great thing to do. He said, but in his opinion, if you have a water heater and let's say it's 7 years old and you've never done that, and now you're hearing me say this and you think I should start doing that, he disagrees with that, because he's like, now there's so much in there and there's so much going on that you can actually cause more problems than you can fixes in possibly doing that flush if you've got a five, 7, 10-year-old water heater, and you've just literally never, ever done it. So there's a lot like that to consider when you see and hear all of this advice. And when you Google things, you also got to think about the source and the area where things are coming from. Where is the information you're gathering coming from also? Because there's differences from different areas. And if you watch a video and someone's building a deck and they say, dig your pier 12 inches deep for your deck post, and that's plenty good, they are in a different area than us in St. Louis. If you even see them, I've seen videos and shows of they're building deck and they basically scrape the ground flat. They set like this concrete block on the ground and then they set their post on that. And they go, all right, we're good. This will hold your deck up. And it's so in certain areas, yep, that's exactly right. That will work. Not in our area. Our frost line is 30 inches deep, 20, 24, something like that. So they tell us put our piers at least 30 inches deep so that the frost never freezes and raises them up. So you might have people in California watching a deck building video digging 30 inches deep for absolutely no reason because they'll never get that much cold and their ground will never freeze that much. So little caution there, caution word to say, just watch what you're seeing, figure out where it is, and talk to good professionals in your area that have a lot of experience because they have the knowledge of where they're at, and that can be a really good thing. So, hey, we're here in St. Louis. We've got those old plaster buildings. We've got all the stuff that we do here in St. Louis with our weather, with our freeze. We've got snow possibly coming next week. No one's looking forward to that. So whatever you have going on around your house, I'm right here. Rich Orris here for you. 314-436-7900 finds me. We've got plenty of time for everybody today. Let's get the phones rolling. Don't go anywhere. Don't touch that dial. I'll have more to come right after these messages. All right, we are back. Super Bowl weekend home improvement show. We got the Chiefs. We got the Eagles. I'm sorry, I'm for the Chiefs. I'm going to just throw that out there. We're going to do the three-peat this year. But, hey, if you're getting ready for that, if you've got a honey-do list you've working on, if you've got questions, concerns about what's happening while you're trying to perform all of this, feel free to give us a shout. We can help you out right here. 314-436-7900. We've got Cecilia on the line. Are you there? Can you hear me?
Yes, I am. Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. You're welcome. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I have a question. I have all of a sudden spot on my bedroom ceiling, like a leak, you know, like a water leak. Okay. Uh-huh. I did have a roofer come out yesterday. He doesn't find any shingles or anything wrong with the shingles, and he went up into the attic and didn't find anything. He indicated that I might have to wait till it rains again to see where the leak's coming from. But meanwhile, I've Googled this and found out there's obviously several reasons I might have that a particular spot. It's like oval-shaped, kind of like an egg, but it's darker, you know, around the outside than the inside. It's not damp to the touch. It's not soft. It's on the, I have it just in the attic, you know, crawl space with lots of insulation up there, so you really can't get up there to see.
Okay.
It's a walkout ranch. The spot is closest to the outside wall, you know, where there's an eave and the gutters and the overhang there, you know, up there close to that end. You have any ideas of what might be causing this? I suspect maybe some kind of, is it just moisture in my attic that's causing this? All of a sudden, it just popped up. It wasn't there gradually. It just went Tuesday. I looked up and there it was.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, so it's absolutely from water or moisture. That's a definite. It's just a matter of trying to figure out where it's coming from and if it's developing like moisture, like condensation, or is it actually a leak during a rain? So there's a lot of ways that those things can happen in an attic, and different ways that I've found is condensation is a big one, where if you have a bathroom nearby and there's a bath fan vent pipe, a lot of times they run that flexible pipe out to the edge of that soffit, and they're hoping it's going to blow all that air out. But what happens a lot of times is that pipe will condensate from warm air being in it from the bathroom, from trying to keep your house warm during the winter and it's cold in the attic. And then that condensation runs and drips off the end of that pipe onto the ceiling right there. So that's one way. So there's some sort of condensation that could be forming on that pipe or another pipe. I've seen plumbing leaks in the attic, to where if you have a plumbing vent, air vent stack that exits your roof in the area, and that pipe may run through the attic, it could run sideways. Sometimes two pipes will connect and then it goes out of your roof. And if something happens to those pipes and rainwater gets into that pipe, then it can leak into your attic. So I've seen that happen. I've seen pipes from solar tube type skylights that are uninsulated, and they condensate and get water on the ceiling. I've been out on a lot of roof leaks and found a lot of other things, but is there access where you can't? Well, he got in the attic, so then
he got it. Yeah, you have to crawl up. I mean, all obviously you have to crawl almost. I mean, you can't really stand up all the way. You can like hunch over.
Yep.
He said that there isn't a stack there close enough that he'd see a leak there. I do have, the bathrooms. I mean, this is a ranch style house, and this is like a walkout, so that side of the house is higher elevations, than the front. The bathroom is on this other wall. I mean, it doesn't go out there. But he said there's no stack there that he could see. Now, the thing is, in my bathroom, we do have air vent, okay? I don't think it's ever been, we've had it replaced, I think, once. It's ever been really vented to the total outside. I think it just goes into the attic, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I don't know, over the years, I've lived in the house 50 years, and I've never, ever seen this happen like that. I thought maybe because of the severe cold and ice, expand, contract on the roof and all that, I thought perhaps that it was just like a shingle or something that had broken or come loose. But I just don't know who to hire. Do I hire a water person, or, I mean, not a roofer, but somebody else? If he says this guy says it's not a leak from the roof. My roof is 5 years. My roof is only 5 years old, actually.
Okay. Yeah.
So I didn't know what kind of a repair a person I should hire to look at that.
Yeah. What you're looking for is somebody that has a lot of experience and knowledge on all the portions of the home.
Mm-hmm.
So at Mosby Building Arts, we have several of us that do this type of thing,
mm-hmm.
that can get up in the attic, can look around, they can look at the roof, they can look in the attic, and it's really the best thing to do is exactly what the roofer was saying. What you're saying is you got to get knee deep, you got to get crawling into this insulation, and you got to find that spot, and you got to work backwards from it and see what you see, because it still could possibly be the roof if you had ice damming occur because of like all that snow we had.
I know.
And if ice damming occurred, you won't see that really well from the roof. The roof looks perfectly fine, but the ice grew uphill backwards underneath your shingles, and then it melted, and then it dripped inside.
Mm-hmm.
So it's it still could be that. And even good roofers are going to look at the shingles and go, no, they look good now. They're not leaking. I can tell you for sure they're not leaking, and not necessarily be able to see that ice damming occurred. But I would strongly recommend, if you want to really get to the root cause, is call call our office at Mosby Building Arts, tell them you talk to me on the air and say, this is what I've got going on in the roofer, and they'll get you to the right consultant to come out and look at that and get up in the attic and do the research and educate you on what we feel is happening. Because yeah, there is a lot of ways.
It's kind of a mystery. When you yep. All you see is insulation up there, you know, and you don't know really what's underneath that. And it's been up that way for many, many, many years. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've seen entire attics frozen from just losing heat from the house. The bath fan doesn't, the pipe doesn't leave the roof. It doesn't go outside. So all this warm air from the home gets into the attic. And when it's really, really cold out, I've seen the entire underside of the roof completely covered with frost. And then it drips because it thaws eventually, and it's water once it thaws. So not that yours is necessarily doing that, especially if you're getting one spot. Those usually have way more spots, but that there's so many ways like that and things that could be occurring, and there's signs if things like that are occurring that we can usually find and show you and let you know.
All right. Well, thank you. I appreciate it. It was just it's kind of a mystery right now, so I was just trying to get some further information. Thank you for your help.
I appreciate the call. You're very, very welcome. And for everyone out there, if you're looking for me or us at Mosby, it's 314-909-1800. We'll get you right to our office. We've got a couple of calls on the line. If we can get through, I'm going to jump into a very, very quick break for you guys, and then we'll get immediately to both of you as soon as the next segment starts. Don't go nowhere. We'll be right back. All right, guys, we're back. And don't forget, after this segment, we'll have a whole nother hour for everybody. 314-436-7900 finds me, like Jenny found me. Let's go straight to Jenny and see what's going on. Are you there? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Great.
Thank you for taking the call.
Oh, you're welcome.
So my house is about 40 years old, and the outer wall in the family room that is where the chimney is, where the wall itself meets the ceiling, it is starting to crack along there, and I don't think I had noticed it before, but I had had the room painted, so maybe they repaired it or something, but now it's definitely showing again. So what do you do in that situation?
So are you talking like right where the ceiling meets the wall?
Yes.
And that's just cracking open?
Yes.
Is it around the actual chimney?
It runs the whole length of the wall at this point.
Okay. Yeah. And so, I mean, the best thing to do to make it last a really long time, because mostly this happens from the wood expanding and contracting, and kind of it'll get bigger, it'll get smaller. It kind of moves around over the seasons, and especially after 40 years of having things happen. So typically when people paint, they'll just caulk that, and then it looks fine until the wood moves again and that caulk breaks. So if you really wanted to try and have it last as long as you can, there's a couple things you can do. One, you can truly repair it, where they come in, they make sure the drywall screwed to the wood really good, all the way down that wall, along the ceiling. And then they take paper tape and they tape in mud and they redo that entire corner. So you kind of dig everything out, you pull the old stuff out, and you just get your drywall, paper tape, and you tape in mud and you redo that entire corner. And it's going to work down the wall, 6 inches to a foot. It's going to work across the ceiling, 6 inches to a foot. You sand, if you have sand texture on your ceiling, you got to kind of redo that in that area. And then you repaint wall, ceiling, everything, and that'll kind of tighten up and button it up the best for now. Another thing that we do often, is the ceiling flat or is it vaulted?
It is flat.
It's flat. Okay. So another thing that we do is you can install crown molding around the room.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what you do is you put some wood backing back there and you attach it to the ceiling really well. And then you attach your crown molding to that wood and to the ceiling really well. And,
okay.
And you paint that crown mold, or you can stain it. If you have a lot of wood in the house and it's like a wood stain, you get oak, you stain it. The key is to not, if you paint the trim, you do not caulk the trim to the wall. You basically paint the wall, you paint the trim down, cut into the wall. And what happens is if that crack wants to open or close, or that wood wants to expand and contract and move around, that crown molding will just kind of slide on the wall.
Okay.
And you'll never see the crack. You'll just have the crown there kind of moving with the crack. So if the crown moves up a 16th or an eighth of an inch, you'll never notice it.
Okay. So it's not cause for greater concern?
No, it's a visual concern. It's just a visual thing. And it's just what houses do. Yeah.
Like settling almost?
Yep. Yeah. A little bit of settling in a house is extremely normal. The thing to watch out for when the corners crack like that is if you see the tape that they use when they drywall and they tape and mud and they float everything out. If you see that paper tape, like about an inch wide in the corner, kind of ripple, like mm-hmm. it's literally, it's got a ripple every 6-8 or inches or a foot or something like that, that might mm-hmm. be enough movement to where it's your house moving. And you might want to look at like some foundation peering, have the house looked at for like major settling, because that's what happens. But typically that's a lot of movement, and you would see it in the corner of a wall as well, like from the ceiling to the floor. You'd probably see it there too. If it were
okay.
like a major settling thing, if it's only the ceiling, it's just the house doing its thing. It's a visual concern. If you're a good painter, caulk it and paint it again.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you.
All right. You're welcome. No problem. No problem. Let's jump to Michael real quick here. See if we can get this in for you, Michael. We got a couple minutes. What's going on?
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. My problem is my water pressure is decreasing. This house is built in the middle 50s, so it's 70 years old, and all of a sudden it just keeps getting less and less. And now I have a faucet in the carport that works break that is fine for the hose.
Uh-huh.
But inside the house, where the water comes in from the floor, it's a slab house, and from the water heater on into the kitchen and the shower and the rest of the house, it's getting less and less.
Okay. So yeah, I would
call a plumber.
Yeah, I would definitely say get with the plumber. More than likely it sounds like if you've got good pressure in some areas and not others, it's probably like calcium, things inside the water lines that have gotten
right.
even to the fixtures and taken off the screens, flushing water through. Flushing water backwards, like that water heater flush I was talking about, and getting that calcium out of there is probably the main cause of sounds like what's happening. If it's not consistent throughout the whole house, so yeah, that's kind of what I would recommend taking a look into and seeing if that can be flushed out. Check all the ends of the faucets. Take off all those kind of edges, the little filters, and see if there's white calcium little deposits blocking that. And yeah, you'll get it at the shower head. You'll get it at your kitchen faucets, your bathroom faucets, all of that. So, hey, we are just about to take our big hour break with news and everything. Hopefully they're going to talk about the Chiefs that are going to whoop up on the Eagles tomorrow during this break, but we got another hour for you, so don't go anywhere. You can find me in the next hour. All right, guys, we are back. Hey, hour two of my favorite 2 hours of the week. Yes, this is my favorite 2 hours of the week. And let's see how we can help out. It's what I love to do. It's what I'm trying to do. And I kind of do this all week during the week, but this, I really get to just get to everybody and have them just call in and see if we can help you out with anything you got going on around your house. So, hey, we've got a whole nother hour left, hour two for you, 314-436-7900. Want to thank Jackie for hanging on during the long news break. Jackie, are you there?
Yes.
All right. What's happening?
All right. When we turn the water on, we kind of get a rumbling, banging sound in the pipes. We drained all the pipes, except I didn't do the washing machine and the dishwasher because I was concerned about messing up the computers on them. And that didn't help.
Okay. Is it happening in multiple places?
Yes.
Have you noticed at all? Does it happen any more with hot water than cold water?
I'm not sure with that. I mean, all right, so when you turn on the shower, you've got both on.
Yeah.
When you have the dishwasher, you've got both on. The washing machine. It's like after the water comes on, this rumbling kind of a sound.
Okay. So, and that's, yeah, because a lot of times air in the lines can be more concentrated where it's happening in one or two places, or it's happening in just this bathroom but not elsewhere. So draining the lines and filling them back up really should have taken care of any of that, but it's pretty rare that it's air in the lines if you're getting it in like laundry room and kitchen and bathroom and spread out throughout the house. So I would say if you could have somebody go downstairs near the hot water heater and see if it's coming from the hot water heater when you turn water on, because it could be coming from something with hot water and like we were just talking about all the sediment buildup in the hot water heater, and the water heater will make like a knocking noise at times. And a lot of times that will happen though, even when you're not running the water, but it still can be once you get that pressure and that hot water moving, it could be coming from the hot water heater. So I would try that. And if somebody's down there, I mean, they can even basically put their hand on the side of that hot water heater. It's the tank itself is not hot. And just kind of like turn the water on and see if you can narrow it down, if it's coming just from that. The other thing
and
could
then
be,
if you find that it is coming from that, then you would out all the water from the water heater.
You could try that. Yeah, you could try and flush it out and put it down. If it's coming from the water heater, I would venture to say if flushing the water heater helped it for a while, it will probably only help it for a while, and you'll eventually be into replacing it. But the other next spot I would go to, if it doesn't seem like it's just the hot water heater, is over to where the main shutoff for the house is, where that water comes into the house and goes up the pipe and starts spreading out. You should have a pressure regulator on that pipe, and you should have a main shutoff on that pipe. So if there's anything restricted there, like a shutoff that's turned off like halfway, could cause like a rumbling, something like that. So if you've got a lot of sediment and it's built up in the shutoff and or that pressure regulator valve, it could be just the fact that the water's being kind of restricted as it's trying to go through, and that's causing it to happen. But yeah, and that really should be kind of the same way, like where the pipe's coming in. You can stand right next to it, and if it starts doing it there, you'll know right away, and you can grab it with your hand and see if you feel it or if it makes it not as bad, and then you know it's in that area. So, but either way, replacing water heater, working on pressure regulator valve and all that, I would highly recommend, you know, once you can narrow it down, you'll be into getting a good licensed plumber in there to replace those parts.
Okay. All right.
All righty.
I appreciate your help. Thank you.
You're very welcome. No problem. No problem at all. We've got Gail on the line. Let's see what's happening with Gail. How you doing?
Fine, Rich. Thanks for taking my call. I was wanting to know, is it too cold now to be walking on a TPO roof? I just got it 6 months ago. But I need to get a flue liner installed. I got a new gas boiler like about 3 months ago in November. But they weren't able to do the flue liner at the time because it was too windy to go up on the roof that day. But now they got me scheduled actually for next week. But I'm thinking it's too cold to be walking on the roof up there.
Not on a TPO roof. Yeah, I think you'll be fine.
Yep.
Especially if it's that new. I mean, it's, yeah, because it's rubber. So that's a great, great product. And I don't, you know, it can definitely withstand some cold and some heat a lot better than like the asphalt, that sort of type of flat roof stuff. So they should be good.
Like, yeah, even if it's like down to like 20 degrees, so they're going to start like at 7 in the morning, although it's scheduled for Wednesday and we're supposed to have snow, so I'm thinking they'll reschedule.
Well, they might. Yeah, I definitely wouldn't want to be up there with snow and ice and all of that, even though it's flat. But, yeah, if it got that sort of condition, I wouldn't recommend them going up onto the roof. But just the cold, just down 20, 30 degrees, whatever, it shouldn't harm your roof.
Okay. Hey, thanks a lot. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. Not a problem at all. Great question and great thing to think about and being concerned about, because there is other types of roof, the asphalt shingles, the asphalt type roll roof that when it gets really, really cold, they can get more brittle. And when it gets really, really hot, that's another time that it's even worse, because you can dig into it. You can kind of move the asphalt pieces around and really damage when it's too terribly hot. You can damage a asphalt shingle pretty easily climbing around on it and trying to do work and everything on it. So definitely something that's great to consider when you have things getting repaired and everything. So good question for you there, Gail. We're going to jump into our first break of this hour. We've got plenty of time for everybody, so keep the calls coming. Having a great time in my favorite 2 hours, and this is the second hour of that. All right, everybody, we are back. Rich Orris here with the Home Improvement Show for you, and we've got plenty of time to get some more calls, conversations, questions in. 314-436-7900. Get you to find me right here today, whatever you may need. And for Gail, with her TPO roof we were just talking about, with the roof being so new, I feel pretty comfortable it's going to work out well. But needless to say that definitely, hopefully they are careful. And because definitely dropping things, sharp objects, the roof could definitely somewhat damage easier under, you know, really cold weather. But hopefully they'll lay something down where they kind of are to distribute weight a little bit, and just careful in their install and everything. And if you do that, I don't see any problems with getting that taken care of and getting that done. But needless to say, yeah, kind of have them make sure that they're just careful while they're up there in what they do and how they do everything that they're doing while they're there. So needless to say, that's a good idea all the time. On any kind of project that you're doing, floor protections, dust protections, roof protections. If you're going to be up on a roof a really long time, having like a pad, a lot of times we would use couch cushions to kind of put your knees and stuff on. It's more comfortable for you, but it also protects the surface and everything while you're up there. So using any kind of precautions year-round is also an extremely, extremely good idea. So we've got some phones going here. We've got Cindy on the line. Let's see what's going on with Cindy. Are you there?
Yes. Hi, hey. Rich.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for calling, Cindy.
Okay. What is the general rule of thumb for having your faucet drip when the temperatures drop?
So, like, how often?
Well,
how steady of a drip, or are you thinking temperature-wise?
Well, 3 weeks ago when it was so cold, usually below 10 degrees, I'll drip the faucet in the basement.
Okay.
And some people are saying that's not really necessary if your house is insulated enough.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So I was just wondering, I didn't want to waste any water if I didn't need to do that.
Yeah, I gotcha. So yeah, I mean, if your house temperature is maintained and, you're insulated well, you don't have a lot of drafts with cold air coming in, yeah, there's definitely not a reason to have the faucet drip if you're in an area where you've never really had a pipe freezing issue or problem before. What I would probably recommend if you're concerned about that is to find a way to monitor the temperature in that area when it's that cold out. So in an easy way to do it, especially if you're thinking like in the basement, they do make thermometers that are kind of like indoor-outdoor thermometers where you can put one outside and you can put one inside and it will show the temperature. So when you look at the one on the inside, it's showing the outside temperature as well as the inside temperature. So if you got, if you found something like that and you put the outside one, it doesn't have to be outside. You could put it in your basement in the area of your concern. And then you can put the other half of it in your common living space, wherever you are, on your kitchen counter or whatever, and kind of just keep your eye on it and go, okay, it's, you know, this, it's getting down to 10, 20 degrees outside. Monitor what the temperature is in that area of the home while it's that cold outside. Just look at that and see if you ever get down below, you know, 40 degrees in that area or something, then it might not be a bad idea to have that drip. But if you don't ever get down like that, then there's, yeah, it'd be a waste of water and your house is warm enough to where your pipes just aren't going to freeze.
Oh, great. Because the one in the basement sink, it is against the outside wall, you know, the water pipe.
Yep.
So I was concerned about that. But at the same time, and usually at night, I'll let it drip. I just hate to waste that water.
Yeah.
I don't have to. So just put a thermometer in the basement, and if it gets below 40 degrees in the basement, then I should consider dripping the faucet.
Yeah, and or you could also consider, if you do see pretty cold temperatures like that, maybe just investigating, having someone come out and figuring out why is your basement so cold? Because there might be some insulation, some air sealing type of work that you could do to where you wouldn't have to worry about it anymore.
Okay. Yeah, it's definitely cooler than upstairs, but I don't think it's that cool. Because
yeah, and
it's a great
probably
answer.
Isn't. It probably isn't, but yeah, monitoring it, and this answer is more for you than it is for the basement, because then it'll make you comfortable that, yeah, it was 10 degrees outside and my basement was 54 degrees or 58 degrees. So yeah, it's fine. It's
okay.
Not going to be
great.
A problem.
Great to know. So 40 degrees is kind of
yeah.
The
if you get below
number.
40, I mean, obviously freezing is 32, but if your basement's getting below 40, it'd probably be a really good idea to just have the house looked at and go, okay, why is this happening? Because there could be some pretty simple fixes to stopping air from infiltrating into the basement that completely warms up that basement.
Okay. I appreciate it, Rich.
Okay. Perfect. All right. So we have Patty on the line. Let's go to Patty and see what's happening there. Patty, what's going on?
Hi, how are you? I was calling because I'm in need of a wash machine, and the place that I called said that they will not put it in if there's corrosion on the faucet that, you know, you hook it up to, and there is some corrosion. What do you recommend how to get that off? Can you use vinegar and a scrub brush or what?
Definitely. If you've got kind of that white kind of corrosion, sometimes it's got a little bit of light green or orange in it. CRL is something you can purchase that's like a cleaner type. You could soak it in and pour it on there. A vinegar mixture works, I hear, works pretty well. I typically buy
that's
a bottle
what
of CLR.
They recommend vinegar,
So, and if there's a way to kind of just get it wet, letting that do its job and work and kind of soak in, you can scrub it with if it's a metal fixture, and it's like a brass threads and all
that's
that,
what it is.
You could use a vinyl brush, you could use like a steel type of, you know, brush, like a metal brush would work really well, as long as you're not on like a plastic type of fixture. And you can scrub it with that, but soaking it on there, letting it sit, soaking it on there, letting it sit in between all the scrubbing, it may be like soak it for 2 or 3 days and then
get it wet.
Do some scrubbing. Well, if you just get it wet in at different times and let it kind of soak in, because that stuff's hard. So it's if you could submerge it, that would be the best. But coming off the wall like that, it's probably hard to submerge. If there's a way you can, if there's a way you could put some in like a Ziploc bag and put the Ziploc bag over the end of that and get it to where it submerges and leave it in that solution overnight, take it off the next day and scrub it, that works really well.
So that CRL that you recommended, does that come in like a spray bottle?
I'm not sure. I've always bought it just in a bottle where you just pour it. Yeah. So
and you could get that at any hardware store or anything, I guess.
Yep.
Okay, well, I'll try that because I need a washing machine. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we all do.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
All right. You are very welcome. Very welcome. Great question. And Brian, if you could hold on through a very short, quick break, let's just get to a break. I want to make sure I've got enough time for you when we come back to get your question answered. Everybody else will be right here, Home Improvement Show. We got another half hour after this. So don't forget, call in. All right, everybody. We are back, Home Improvement Show. Got a lot of show left for everybody. Don't be shy. Don't be a stranger. 314-436-7900 is where you can find me. And, you know, without you guys, I don't know that there's just not much here. I don't know how exciting this would be. You guys really, you make the show, and you're, it's really all about what you're doing, what you got, and everything happening. So let's get to Brian on the line here and see what's happening. Brian, you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, thanks for your call.
Well, thank you. I've got hardwood floors that I want to either screen or lightly sand and then put a new surface or sealer down, varnish or some other product. What product?
Most of those products are going to be just, most of them, what they're using is going to be just a water-based urethane gloss sealant that they put over it. I mean, it'll say in the stores, I if you're doing this yourself, I definitely probably wouldn't do an oil. But I know too, if you screen it, there is something to be said that I think a lot of flooring guys would say if you know what was on it before, doing the same type of product can be an important thing, because if you're putting like oil over water or water over oil, that sort of thing, I know sometimes you can run into some issues there as far as if you've got a lot of oil on the floor, if you've been cleaning the floor with like an oil-based type of cleaner that leaves a film, you want to make sure that's kind of off of there to make it work really well. So do you have any knowledge of what was applied to the floor the first time it was done?
No real knowledge. My guess is it was a water-based product.
Yeah.
So.
Yep. And that's what's used most of the time, pretty typical, and that's what I would go with.
What about a spar varnish?
Yeah, I just don't know that they're doing a whole lot of that kind of varnish.
No benefits?
No, not really. None that I really know of anyways. There might be some flooring people out there that might, you know, beg to differ a little bit on certain instances or whatever, but it's just not typical when you're doing your, you know, most hardwood installs. They're just going with the sand and the stain and then the coats on top of it. And it's really a matter of using the same thing as before is the most important piece of it. Making sure you clean it well, screen it really well. You don't have to completely sand it. They do, just like a light screen and then a recoat all the time.
Okay. Any way to test it to see whether it was oil or water-based or...
So not that I know of. Most really good flooring guys can kind of walk in and look at the floor and know by the sheen, by how it looks and feels. I don't personally know of any way to test it out to see what it is.
Okay. No, that's helpful. Wait till spring when I can open it up and let it air dry and do it.
Yep. And then after that, just, you know, light mopping, Swiffer, just a very, very damp mop. You don't want a lot of chemicals. You don't want harsh cleaners. You don't want oil kind of base cleaners that shine and all that stuff to it later on for the next person or the next time you go to refinish again or anything. You just, it's real super easy to maintain that way. So, hey, we've got Ann on the line. Let's see what's going on with Ann. Are you there? Can you hear me?
Hi, yes. Thank
awesome.
You very much.
You're welcome.
Hey, well, I'm trying to figure out if I need a tuck pointer or someone specialized in stone for my problem. My problem is I have stone steps leading to my front porch, and they seem fine. The flat horizontal surface seems fine. The vertical supporting sections between them are also stone. They're more or less rectangular in shape, but they're very lumpy and bumpy. They aren't smooth like a brick. Now, those vertical sections are losing mortar or whatever that is between the stones. So I need to have the mortar or whatever it is replaced or repaired, and I don't know if that can be done by a tuck pointer or if I need someone specializing in stone. And I wonder what you would advise.
So a quick question for you. So on the flat surface that you say is good, is there mortar in between some of the flat stones that you're actually stepping on?
Yes, there
is.
And
that's in good shape?
Yes.
Yeah. So it sounds to me like maybe there's a possibility maybe they've done some repairs in the past, because usually the flat surface is the first one to go and the vertical surface lasts longer.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be a possibility that they had some mortar replaced and some tuck pointing done on the horizontal surfaces, and now the vertical surfaces are starting to wear. But mortar between brick, stone, all those things, a good tuck pointing company should be able to dig out, grind out, clean out, and re-mortar between stones, as long as you're not looking at replacing stones, that sort of thing. Any type of good tuck pointing company should work really well for you, as long as they're good. The main thing to watch with tuck pointers is how much of the mortar they dig out. So the other thing I might recommend is to, if you're calling some tuck pointers and having them look at it and talk to you about repairing it, also call like a bricklayer.
Oh.
And talk to both, because a tuck pointer can take care of this very well if they do a good job. The biggest thing I personally have seen out of a lot of tuck pointers is that when they grind out mortar, a lot of times it wouldn't hurt for them to grind more, to go a little deeper and just get more new mortar in there, and then it could possibly last longer. So I've just seen a lot of tuck pointing come out, and they're like, well, I had that tuck pointed, you know, 3 years ago. And I'm like, well, but they only ground down and replaced about a quarter inch of mortar, and they really should have been more like 3/4 inch. And so it's really the quality of the people and the company and who you have there when you do it, that sort of thing. So I would have conversations with even both and talk to them about it, and maybe ask the question, like when you are having the conversation, if you've got a tuck pointer saying, oh yeah, we'll dig that out, we'll do this, ask some questions like, well, how do you dig it out? And how much do you dig? Like, how deep do you go? How deep should I go? And see what they say, and then just hold them accountable to that.
Okay. Well, thanks. That helps me out a lot. Thank you very much.
Oh, no problem. Very welcome. Very welcome. Let's jump into Linda here and see what's going on with Linda.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, Linda?
I'm good.
Good.
Okay, this is kind of an oddball one. I have, it only happens in my master bathroom upstairs. I have two bathrooms upstairs. One of them is not affected. And then lately I've been hearing it in the, from the washing machine, which is like on the back side of the wall of the bathroom off the bedroom. Anyway, that doesn't happen all the time, but most of the time. After I use a faucet in the tub or the toilet, or the faucet in the sink, I hear this high-pitched, I've got perfect pitch, and it's an A. It's a really high-pitched note. And it just goes. And sometimes, though, in the middle of the night, I hear it. It just comes on, and I wasn't even in there using the water. And I don't know, I've turned the water off to the house, turned it back on. I've done everything I think I know what to do, and that just keeps happening. And it's been going on probably a year. Do you think it's bad?
Well, I definitely think something's happening. And usually when you get a noise like that, it's typically from some sort of restriction of the water running through a pipe. So I would question, I don't typically hear it from this, but if there's air in the pipe, so the water's moving with the air, maybe that's kind of what's happening, and maybe trying to flush those lines could possibly help that. But I do question if there isn't something running at times, if your toilet isn't like filling itself back up at times, and as the water is moving through the pipe, because really that noise is typically happening with water moving through a pipe. And since you know so much about pitch, it's kind of like the water in the glass, and you do your finger around the glass, and each sound pitch is different. Well, it's kind of the same thing. It's like depending on how restrictive it is, you'll get a higher pitch or a lower pitch of that water moving. So it's the part you were talking about, hearing it at night when you're not doing anything or nothing's happening, makes me question, is there water moving when you're not using it for some reason, which would be like, is there an issue with the washing machine shut off on the actual machine itself that's maybe letting a slight bit of water seep into the machine when it's not supposed to? And that's something like that is what I would be curious about.
So
that's something I'd kind of look into.
Okay, because it's just something new now with the washing machine. And it's not all the time, but it's most of the time.
Yeah, and it could literally be like your washing machine constantly has water pressure to it, and there's a valve that's saying don't let water in the washing machine, so when the pressure changes in the pipes, like say you flush the toilet, so now the water runs, so now the pressure changes in the pipes, so it leaks slightly into that washing machine. Or something like that. I see it a lot in toilets where your toilet basically has the same type of valve. So if you're losing water in the toilet tank real slightly and it goes to fill itself back up, it might just barely turn on and you don't hear the water running, but you hear the noise because it's trying to let a little bit of water in. And it's also trying to be shut off. So it could be from that toilet also. And it could happen when you do the faucet because of the change in the pressure.
So would I call a plumber for this problem?
Well, you'll be stuck between a plumber if it's something with the toilet and an appliance repair person if it's something with the washing machine.
With the washing machine. Okay.
Yep. Okay. And it'd be hard to tell because you'd almost have to like, have the washing machine open and be standing over it with your head real close to it when someone else is using the bathroom or something to see if you notice any sound from that washing machine.
Okay, that's interesting.
Try and maybe pinpoint it, almost like putting a stethoscope on, listening to the heart or something. That's the detail you're trying to get into. It might be tough.
Okay.
All right.
Hi, thanks for your help. Appreciate it.
Oh, no, you're welcome. Thanks for the call. We're going to get into our final break. Pat, if you can hold on the line, I will get you on as soon as we get through this really quick short break for you. More to come with Pat as soon as we return. All right, we are back. Final segment, as promised. Let's get right to Pat and see what's going on. Want to make sure we get enough time here for Pat. So, Pat, are you there? Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Thanks, Rich, for taking my call.
Oh, thank you for holding.
Oh, a couple of weeks ago, I called and asked a question about, we have three ridge vents on our roof, and they're squeaking, and you advised instead of just silicone or oiling them to go ahead and replace them. And so I called our roofer, and he came, and he did that. And we put the roof on in 2017. At that time, my husband researched and felt that's better to have the ridge vents, the turbines.
Yeah, turbines. Yeah, okay.
Turbines.
Yep.
Versus the ridge vents. And so now the roofer is saying back in 2017 that may have been the case, but now it's better to have a ridge vent versus the three turbines. And he did oil them for us, and the difference would be if he replaced the turbines with a ridge vent is like $300. Our soffit is open. It's not enclosed. And my husband felt we're not getting enough of the air circulation because we don't have the vents in the side of the overhang. So what is your opinion?
So are you saying that down near the gutter line you do not have an opening down low that's letting air in at the soffits?
The whole overhang is, it's not enclosed. It's not got the enclosure from siding.
Okay. So you can see the underside of the plywood and the wood from the rafter, yes, and everything from there.
Yes, sir. Uh-huh.
And so there wood blocks in between that's basically blocking airflow from getting in there then?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Into the attic.
Yeah. Yeah. Into the attic. So something that you could consider doing is it really wouldn't match the airflow 100% whether you have the turbines or the ridge vent, but you could go under that kind of soffit area where those 2x4s are. They're called bird blocks in the industry. They're basically put in there to block birds from entering into your attic, is kind of where it even got the name. You can go there and you can drill holes in that board, and they make these little vents that you put in the hole, and it'll keep out, you know, it'll have like a screen and little louvers, and it's like an inch and a half hole. So if you drilled a couple of those and put those metal vents in there, it would let some air in from down low, and that would be better than no air. But that would make your whole attic ventilation system somewhat better. So that's a thought for maybe a project somewhere down the road in the future. But I think in theory, the ridge vent and the turbines are going to work fairly similar to one another. And what you may be up against is we're getting into a time where roofers don't want to put turbines on. So you may be better off just going with the ridge vent. It will work as well as the turbines will. It will still let air off when wind blows. It'll let air out, and it should help you really well. So I think that's more what you're up against, but I would look at that. And unfortunately, Pat, we're totally out of time. We're right at the end here, but I think that's where you're at, and that's what I would do. So we can talk more next week. For everybody else out there, be good to yourselves and your house. I'll talk to you next week.